Everything is ready for the show. Let's go.
And good evening and welcome to this week's edition of Musical Theatre Melodies, a program which comes to you over the airwaves of 96.5 Inner FM every Tuesday evening between the hours of 9 and 11 p.m., hosted by yours truly, Rob Morrison. And welcome to any international or interstate listeners we may have listening in via the World Wide Web. Well, this year marks the 120th anniversary of the first production of Edmond Rostand's historical romance, Cyrano de Bergerac, which premiered at the Porte Saint-Martin Theatre in Paris on December the 28th, 1897. And on tonight's programme we shall hear a musical adaptation of Rostand's play by Leslie Bricus, who also provided the lyrics to Frank Wildhorn's music, as performed on a 2006 US concept album featuring Douglas Sills in the title role, with Linda Eder as Roxanne. But now it's my very great pleasure to welcome back to the programme, via telephone from the south of France, the Oscar, Grammy and Ivor Novello award-winning composer, lyricist and librettist, Leslie Bricus. Good afternoon, Leslie.
Good evening, Rob. How are you?
Good to hear you. Yes, well, could be better. I've got a head cold, but we soldier on. And I guess it's
an attractive baritone voice.
Indeed. And I guess it's quite appropriate that you should currently be in France, as that's where you first attended a performance of Edmond Rostand's play on your first trip to Paris post-war, I believe.
Yes, I was still at Cambridge in those days, and I was an exchange student. And at the Châtelet Theatre in Paris, which is the most beautiful theatre in Paris, I first saw Cyrano, and I fell in love with it, as the whole world does. And I was determined that at some point in my life, if I were able to, I would write a musical of it. Mm-hmm. And it took many decades. I mean, it took about 50 years for it to happen. But with my partner, Frank Wildhorn, whom I wrote Jekyll and Hyde with, he felt to me like the right person to tackle it. It's a very dramatic score and a very romantic score.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a wonderful job in it. I think it's even better than Jekyll and Hyde myself.
Ah, right. And I guess you originally saw it performed in its original French, so how fluent were you in French back in those days?
Well, I was studying French literature, so it was not altogether out of place.
Ah. Yes, I recall that I first became aware of Cyrano de Bergerac, oddly enough, on a Mr. Magoo cartoon. There was a whole series back in the mid-1960s where he portrayed all these famous characters from literature, including Cyrano de Bergerac. So.
Well, this is slightly different from that.
Indeed, yes. But I did get to see a live production of it, staged by the Melbourne Theatre Company for a seven-week season back in 1985. And they got by with a cast of 28. So apart from the six principal characters, needless to say, there was a lot of multiple role-playing amongst the rest of the cast members to cover the large number of characters in the play. And there were quite a few. So I guess in your adaptation, you had to decide which the minor characters you wanted to keep and which to get rid of, so to speak.
Well, it is, if you're not careful, a monumental cast in the piece, so I kept it down to the main singing characters. And the problem with Cyrano was that although the play by Rostand was public domain, the translation to which we had access by a man called Brian Hooker was still in copyright.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't occur to me for several years, finally, that since I speak French or understand the language, I could do my own translation, and that was what unlocked the door.
Uh-huh.
So that enabled me to go ahead with it a few years ago, and we finally got what I think is a pretty respectable piece.
Yes, yes. And the other thing about the original play, of course, is it runs for just on 3 hours, but then if you factor in intervals to give the audience some comfort break, so to speak, it'll run well over 3 hours.
As I was able to do my own translation, I was able to edit as well as translate.
Mm-hmm.
So that brought the time down, otherwise it would have been a six-hour musical, you know.
Indeed. And I guess a lot of dialogue, of course, turns into songs.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, once I'd solved the problem of how to do it, it wasn't difficult, and its running time is pretty close to 3 hours, even so, because you have to give the ideas time to develop, and musically, there's a lot of, as you'll hear, there is a lot of good stuff in it that Frank wrote.
And we'll be listening to a 2006 US concept album, but I guess the musical has evolved since that time, has it? Just as the Jekyll and Hyde
yes,
did.
Yes, it has. We recently opened the show in Seoul, the city of Seoul, South Korea, where Frank has great standing. He's had a lot of successes down there, and the producers have given us a big production, and I was not able to go because I was working in Europe, but Frank was here staying with me recently, and he said it's a big success, and it's also been very successful in Japan. So we're now going to aim for an English production, hopefully in the next year.
Mm-hmm. And do you get any feedback from the translators of these productions, or do they virtually have a free rein to translate it into their native language?
Yes, I mean, there's not a lot you can do about that, because the phrasing of certain expressions is not the same in any language. So you have to, you know, I think the version of Cyrano that we did in Japan was translated by the lady poet laureate of Japan, which was pretty complimentary.
Indeed.
So you just have to trust that the quality of the work will be good. And it the fact that it's played now four different times in Japan proves, I think, that she did her job well.
Ah, great. And I guess you have to share the royalties with the translator too for a certain percentage.
I haven't thought about that. I really don't know.
Oh, right. That's the producer's role, I guess, in those particular productions.
No, I think, in fact, I don't think we do. I think that's a separate royalty that the producers have to pay. I don't recall that I was called upon to sacrifice anything. But if I were, it would be all right, but I'm sure we didn't.
Mm-hmm. And I possibly asked you this question when we spoke about Jekyll and Hyde a couple of years ago, but what's the usual method of songwriting that you adopt with Frank Wildhorn with regard to writing the music or the lyrics first, or is it a combination of...
No, Frank always goes first. I'm happy to give him the freedom because he writes such good stuff that I can always accommodate what he gives me.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike Tony Newley and myself, where we both sat in a room and hammered it out, words and music, until it was done. That was a very bizarre operation because we're neither of us professional composers. Working with a composer is always a job where I'm happy to let the composer go first and fit into his work.
Mm-hmm.
Newley and I were different, very, very unlike probably any writing relationship in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of had one mind. It was a very strange, wonderful relationship where we kind of fell into the same groove on everything we wrote, and we would even write part of a line together, a musical phrase together, and we just jog it forward. I remember the first thing we ever worked on, which was John Barry's Goldfinger.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of wrote the lyric in one sitting, where I think the key to that song, Goldfinger, was the man with the Midas touch. That gave us the lead, and we just talked it through all the way, and it's fascinating. It's very unlike any other writing relationship I've ever had.
Ah, yes.
And probably the best one.
And you worked, of course, with many great composers over the years, as you mentioned last week, John Williams and also Henry Mancini too.
Yep, those three, John Barry won 5 Oscars, Henry Mancini won 4 Oscars. John Williams has so far won 5 Oscars with more than 50 nominations, which is the most anybody's ever had except for Walt Disney.
Mm.
But Walt Disney wasn't a one-man band as as John is.
Yes, yes. So.
He's the Mozart of the movies.
Indeed, and there's nobody on the horizon who will overtake him, no doubt, in the near future at least. So.
I don't think it will happen in the distant future either. I think this will be an all-time record.
Indeed.
To sustain for more than half a century getting, you know, constant nominations is unlikely. It's because of the special relationship between John Williams and Steven Spielberg that it happened at all.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I'm not sure that I've ever asked you, but what is your technique when writing music? Can you write the dots on the paper, or do you just record the music and then have a secretary transcribe it for you?
I put the melody down in a simple line and give it to well, for 50 years I gave it to my lovely arranger, Ian Fraser, who worked with Newley and myself, and then came with me when I went to Hollywood and worked on all the movies that I did there. Ian was my right-hand man in every sense. He was great.
Yes, yes. It's surprising how many well-known theatre composers couldn't write music. George M. Cohan, Noel Coward, and famously, of course, Irving Berlin, who could only play in one key.
Yes, but he didn't do bad, did he?
No, indeed not.
Irving Berlin was the first composer who had to sue because his works became public domain. Originally, in a music contract, a copyright lasted 56 years, 28 years plus another 28 years. And in his 80s and 90s, he complained that he was being done out of a living because his works were public domain. So they changed the copyright law in America to accommodate it, which was to all our benefits, of course, because the copyright term is now longer than it used to be.
Indeed, yes, although British copyright, of course, I think was 50 years after the author's death, but I think that's been amended too.
It's now 70 years now, your lifetime plus 70 years.
Mm-hmm.
So although you're not here to enjoy it, someone is, and that's good.
Indeed. So it'll benefit all your ears, etc. Well, I note the first attempt to write a musical version of Cyrano de Bergerac was by Victor Herbert in a production which opened on Broadway in September of 1899, but it only ran for 28 performances.
That was pretty soon after the play, wasn't it?
Indeed, yes, only a couple of years later.
Yes, I didn't know that.
But not one of Herbert's great successes. I don't think there are any standards from that particular show that we're familiar with as some of his other music. And there was a later Broadway production in 1973 which starred Christopher Plummer, over which you felt somewhat betrayed because it involved your then agent, Richard Gregson.
Yes, Richard was a wonderful agent, and through the early years he was my representative. And then I introduced him to Natalie Wood, who was a pal of ours, and he married her.
Mm-hmm.
And they were married, and then because of the marriage, he moved into production, and he made a film with Robert Redford called Downhill Racer, and then he became a producer, and the second thing he produced was Cyrano de Bergerac. I had been working with Chris Plummer to do my Cyrano, so when Richard came along having used a completely different team of people, I think Anthony Burgess was involved, that was not pleasing to me, and I put it aside for another, more than a decade before I came back with Frank.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And you also write in your autobiography, which we'll mention later, that you'd been working on the idea of Cyrano since the early 1960s at least, and you mentioned it to David Merrick, and that had unfortunate consequences too.
Yes, I can't remember what they were with David. Oh, I don't know. It was.
He bought the rights to the translation.
That's right. And then, of course, I realized years later, as I said, that I didn't need that translation. I could do my own translation, but it took me 20 years to realize that.
Mm-hmm. And apart from the great success the musicals had in Asia, oddly enough, some of the productions that were slated, I believe, in London for 2006 and also in Spain have unfortunately been...
We've had some very, very near misses. Michael Ball, the English singing star, was very keen to do it, and he went to New York with Frank, and in this era, a producer called Bill Kenwright was involved. And that one fizzled out as well. So we've had some bad luck with it before the good luck, but that's not unusual in the musical theatre.
Indeed, yes.
Patience is the thing you learn.
As you mentioned with Noah's Ark, which has been around since, the early 60s too, and you're still waiting for a production of that too.
Well, that's going to end up, I think, the way things are, that's going to end up as an animated movie.
Ah, right. Yes, I guess that'd be a great way of rendering the animals, so you can literally have the cast of thousands.
Yes, it's all sitting there ready to go. The animated movie is not much different from the stage play, which is also there. But it's a case of figuring out. I think what may happen with that one, we're doing a revival of Dr. Dolittle next year, using a lot of puppets for the animals. You know the people who did War Horse. Have you had War Horse in Australia?
Oh, yes, we had the National Theatre production
That wonderful team of people who did that are working on the revival of Dr. Dolittle, which opens this time next year.
Oh, okay.
And I'm talking with the producers of that about Noah's Ark, because you could use the same technique for both shows. It was because of the first draft of Noah's Ark that I got Dr. Dolittle in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The producer of the film had heard the songs I'd written for the stage show, and he went to 20th Century Fox and said, "I found a guy who writes songs about animals."
And, of course, there was the Richard Rodgers production 2x2 back in the 60s, which starred Denny Kaye.
Well, that was because of me.
Oh, okay.
Richard Rodgers, I was in New York, and they happened to bring out that week the Rodgers and Hart songbook and the Rodgers and Hammerstein songbook, which were two beautiful productions. So I bought them both, and I called his office, and I said to his secretary, "Would Mr. Rodgers be kind enough to sign these books for me?"
Mm-hmm.
So she said, "Hold on," and he came on the line and said, "Where are you?" I said, "I'm at the Plaza Hotel." He said, "Well, meet me in the Oak Room for lunch at 12:30, which was wonderful. So
yes.
I did.
Uh-huh.
And he signed the two books, and then we started talking about musicals. And the two ideas I was dealing with at the time, one was Noah's Ark and the other was Henry VIII.
Mm-hmm.
And after a week of chats, we had lunch every day, and I got very excited about it and thinking, well, there's going to be a third book called Rodgers and Brickers. But I told Richard, the same Richard Gregson, my agent, I said, "Wonderful news for you. Richard Rodgers wants to work with me."
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, "You can't, because you're under contract to 20th Century Fox till the end of next year." So I had to say to Richard Rodgers, "No, I can't work with you," which was a heartbreaking moment for me.
Indeed.
But Richard Rodgers went on to do, he found a play called The Flowering Peach,
mm-hmm.
which was, a famous playwright.
Oh, Clifford Odets.
Yes, bravo, that's well done. And he bought the rights to that and did a musical called 2x2, starring my next-door neighbor in California, Danny Kaye.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And Danny did it for a year. And then the only other musical Richard Rodgers wrote after that was about Henry VIII. It was called Rex, and it was not a success. I forget who the lyricist was, but that was the end of the story.
Uh-huh. So I guess you've been rather reluctant to discuss projects ever since then.
No, I would have, you know, Richard Rodgers' gift for melody was so amazing that that it would have been a great privilege, but it just was not meant to be.
Ah, right. Yes, I recall that he was a boyhood hero of yours after seeing the MGM musical biography Words and Music. That's right,
Words and Music, yes. That was, of course, what I was seeing for the first time was the wonderful talents of Gene Kelly, who became one of my heroes and one of my pals when I got to Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
He was a fabulous guy, just a terrific man.
Indeed. And I brought up your autobiography, but we can give it a full plug now, or a sort of biography, as you term it. Pure Imagination, The Life and Good Times of a Songwriter, which was published in 2015, and an update of your earlier memoirs from 2006. And I've actually got both books, and when I got the second one, I thought, oh, I'll just have to read the final few chapters. But then I discovered you'd inserted all sorts of additional passages right throughout the very book, so I'll have to go through at some stage and catch up with them.
Yes, there's so many. It's called a sort of biography because it's as much about other people as about me. You know, I've met so many wonderful people in the course of the years that I kept popping in different stories that I remember from wonderful times that we had all over the planet.
Mm-hmm. And also, well, somewhat unfortunately, not only is it a great tribute to your marriage to your beloved wife, Evie, but also it chronicles all the broken marriages of your friends over the years. So I guess it's a great testament that you've been with Evie for, what, almost 60 years?
60 years next year, but everyone can't find an Evie, unfortunately.
No.
I got the only one, so we've had a wonderful time together and still do, and we'll be travelling around doing a lot of things next year, which we love doing.
And at the age of 86, you obviously show no signs of slowing down. I guess keeping busy and keeping working keeps the brain active and gives you a great zest for life.
Yes, I can't imagine. You know, retirement is a strange word. For me, I think, you know, you'll say that's the end if you retire. And you don't need to if your brain half works. And, you know, I had Frank Wildhorn here yesterday. He just went on to Venice from here, as I said. And, you know, we've got a new movie project that we're thinking about doing. And I've got a couple of stage things lined up to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And did I ever tell you that I put lyrics on all the instrumental works by George Gershwin?
Oh, yes, I believe you did in a past interview, yeah.
You know, Rhapsody in Blue and American in Paris, because it's public domain in the rest of the world. It's not yet public domain in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably the best work I've ever done, and it dramatizes those wonderful melodies. And it just occurred. It was Liza Minnelli's idea. We were spending Christmas with her in Hawaii one year, and we watching the Gene Kelly's film, American in Paris, which her father had directed in 1950.
Yes, yes.
And she said, I've always wanted to sing that being da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, and I said, okay, we'll put a lyric on it.
Uh-huh.
And that was the beginning of a fateful couple of years, because it took so long, and I suddenly realized the whole thing would sing. And I had a very difficult time with certain members of the Gershwin family, not all of them, but one particular nephew.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided to wait out the copyright.
Oh, okay.
Which I have done.
Yes.
And now we're talking about doing it in Europe. And it becomes PD in America in a couple more years, so it will be free to happen.
Ah, right. No, I guess that's done as a song cycle in the concert hall, is it?
Well, yes, you can do it all sorts of ways. You can do it as a performance. You can do it as a bunch of little one-act plays. They all have a story behind them, so the potential is quite interesting. I'm working with a director that I've already worked with before, and he would love to do it, and so we'll see what happens.
Ah.
We'll talk again in a year's time, and I'll let you know what happened.
Indeed. And you also mentioned in a past interview, too, about putting your song lyrics to Henry Mancini's existing music and having a stage musical version of The Pink Panther.
Yes, that is, again, mired in copyright problems. I have actually written a play and a score involving Henry, but it's all caught up in copyright problems, because there are so many demands and difficulties about freeing it. But I've been talking to MGM, and hopefully we'll unravel it one day. I don't know that we will, but because it's such a valuable piece. And I was working on it with Blake Edwards, you know, towards the end of his life.
Yes, yes.
And it didn't get finished, and that's when the complications started.
Uh-huh.
But we all had such a good time. You know, we did Victor Victoria together, and Hank and I did a few of the Pink Panthers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a wonderful relationship, so I wouldn't want to do anything to spoil it.
Indeed. And also your musical biography on Sammy Davis Jr., which I think was due to tour in the UK. Has that taken off?
Yes, well, that is all set to go, but an amazing thing happened. We finally, after 6 years of searching, I found the perfect Sammy. It was an English actor called Giles Torreira, who looks perfect. He's a kind of good-looking version of Sammy, and he worships Sammy, and he wants to do it. But earlier this year, he got offered the lead in the musical Hamilton, which is the greatest success ever, probably, I think, in the theatre. It's a, you know, big hit in New York, and it's going to open in London in December. And I said to Giles, he was prepared not to do Hamilton, because he so is besotted by Sammy.
Yes.
And I said, I'm prepared to wait a year. You've got to do Hamilton. You can't not do Hamilton. And I think the status you will have at the end of that year will be more. So we're going straight into Sammy after Hamilton.
Ah, right.
Which opens at the Victoria Palace Theatre in London, which has apparently been beautifully renovated by Cameron McIntosh, who loves the theatres he owns and takes beautiful care of them.
Indeed,
so
yes.
That's the situation there. And, of course, I've got the little musical of the book called Pure Imagination, which is a songbook show which we did in London last year called Pure Imagination.
Yes.
That's going out into little theatres. It's just a bunch of songs, no dialogue at all.
Uh-huh, right.
It's quite charmingly directed by a man called Christopher Renshaw. Christopher Renshaw's, he did The King and I in Australia for John Frost the year before last. He works a lot in Australia. He has a very good relationship with John Frost.
Yes, uh-huh. And yes, that was the one that was whimsically titled Brick by Brick by Brickus by one of your friends, I believe.
That was a producer Bill Kenwright's idea, so I wasn't sure about that one. So we ended up with Pure Imagination.
Indeed, yes. Well, we wish you every success with your future projects and also with getting your current musicals into production. Are there any you still have in the trunk that you'd like to dust off and hope might get?
The one that's actually doesn't need dusting off, which is going into production in London, is called Sunday Dallas, which is already underway for preparation. It will be 18 months away because it's a big show. That's about a girl called Sunday Dallas who is at the tail end of her career and she can't get the Broadway hit she wants, so she auditions for three separate shows using another name, so she has three different names, and she gets all three of the understudy parts. Mm-hmm. And in Act Two, of course, they're all off on the same night, and she has to perform three shows at once. So that's the idea, and I love it. It's a funny show, and we've got some producers in London who actually want to do it. So
that
will be the next one up.
Indeed, a full-scale musical or a small-scale musical?
Oh, big. It's a big show.
Ah, right.
Mm-hmm. You can't do it small. I wish you could, but you're looking at four musicals. You're looking at the story I'm telling and the three musical that she's in.
Right. Uh-huh.
So it's very complicated. In Act Two, the three characters play a blonde, a brunette, and a redhead, so you know what's going on. Then you have girls double for her so that she can get changed and go from... So we have the next series of meetings are with the designers to work out how you achieve it. The idea came to me, there are three theatres in Broadway that have stage doors that open onto the same alleyway.
Yes, yes.
It's the Majestic, the Royale, and the John Golden Theatre, those three. And that's what gave me the idea.
Ah.
I was going backstage with one of them, and I suddenly realised there are three stage doors side by side. So we adapted that idea, and there we are. That's
yes.
How it began.
Ah, great. Yes, I recall the Ivan Novello musicals or operettas. He had a contralto, Olive Gilbert, who was a great favourite, and he had two shows running concurrently at the same time, so he worked out that if he didn't have Olive Gilbert in the second act, she could go to the next theatre and sing a song in one of his other shows and then come back in time for the third act. So.
Good for her. She gets paid twice. Very nice.
Indeed, yes. So such things do happen in real life too.
And yes, it's stranger than fiction.
So have you composed the music for that particular musical, Sunday Dallas, as well?
Yes, I'm booked music and lyrics on that one.
Ah, right. So I guess it gives you an opportunity to compose in the three different styles for the three different musicals that she's appearing
exactly
in.
Exactly right.
Quite a feat indeed. Well, time is getting on, so we'd like to thank you very much, Leslie, for coming online for the past 3 weeks to introduce the three musicals, Dr. Dolittle, Goodbye Mr. Chips, and Cyrano de Bergerac. And, of course, wish you every success, A, in getting Jekyll and Hyde on in English-speaking country, and also eventually Cyrano de Bergerac too.
It's uphill all the way, but it's fun.
Indeed.
And it's lovely to talk to you, Rob. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome, and thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us here in Australia and also all over the world, too, via the internet.
Thank you, man. God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye for now, and all the very best. And I've been speaking with the Academy, Grammy and Ivan Novello Award-winning composer, lyricist and librettist and sometimes screenwriter, Leslie Brickus. Well, let's pause now on the program for some community service and sponsorship announcements before returning with tonight's musical presentation of Cyrano de Bergerac, with adaptation and lyrics by Leslie Brickus and music by Frank Wildhorn. You're listening to 96.5 Inner FM.